Welcome to the No Film School podcast for Thursday, March 28th, 2024. This is Gigi Hawkins. I'm here with Charles Hain and Jason Hellerman. And this week we are talking about bombing interviews in Hollywood, what it means when somebody says they want to read your script and then never get back to you, some strategic career errors we've made, and finally, troubleshooting tech 101.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
First story, Grant Vance this week on the website had a great story telling an amazing anecdote about crashing his first job interview. He got a job interview to be an assistant to a major A-list. I mean, I think we can call that an A-list studio director. He's directing large budget studio movies. Yeah. Ivan Reitman, and bombed the interview and shared really beautifully about why he bombed his interview. First off, great that he managed to get into an interview doing that. Like, that's amazing. Like, that says something more than anything else. But once you get there, what can we learn about bombing an interview? I thought the most beautiful thing he talked about and shared in the article, and I think is a huge takeaway, is he didn't actually understand what the job was when he went in for the interview.
Yes. Yeah.
And you cannot. So if I could go back to 18-year-old me and give 18-year-old me advice, which is frankly what I do as a film school professor, I'm always giving like 24-year-old people all of the things I wish I knew. Mm-hmm. And it changes generationally. I remember when I was in film school, one of my favorite professors, Elliot Silverstein, had made some mistakes in the 60s, and he was very upfront about the mistakes he'd made. Now, I've never been in a place where I've gotten to make his level of mistakes. Like, his level of mistakes were how he dealt with studio suits. And like, he had some regrets about how he dealt with Universal Studios. And like, hopefully I will get to take his lessons on how to deal with studio stuff into my future, but I haven't quite been swinging at that level. But I can say that like, over-researching is never a mistake when you are given an opportunity. Like, looking for every single bit of information you can find about what a position entails, how other people have done it. And one of the beauties of 2024 is if you look up a job, there will be 50 articles on medium.com or elsewhere explaining all of the responsibilities of a job, what it can be, what it might do. And one of the reasons you do that research is to show people that you are thorough. Because I will say this, I interview constantly. I'm always interviewing prospective students for the school, but also prospective hires, all of these things. One of the biggest flags for me is when people have no questions. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest like green flags, you know, to do McConaughey's green lights. One of the green lights I'm always looking for is I'm looking for people who have really concrete, realistic questions that tell me they know what the job is.
Right.
If I get to the end of a chat and I'm like, what are your questions? And they're like, I don't really have any. Well, I'm usually like, all right, that's a huge red flag that you don't know anything of what you're going to do.
That is a hardcore problem if you don't know. I think less and less now job descriptions in film and TV come with what they actually are. You know, I do mm-hmm. feel like back in the day, and look, I was an assistant in 2013. When you'd be applying for things, you'd be like, you're applying to be this person's assistant. It is either light or heavy personal stuff with blah, blah, blah. They have like a house that you're doing. Are you doing like picking their kids up from school? Or is it going to be more like giving notes on screenplays or just screwing in light bulbs at their house, right? Like, what is the actual thing? And now when I look at these things, whether they're on Deed or even, you know, posted in film and TV stuff, a lot of it just says like generic television assistant or film assistant. You know, is this on set? Well, am I spinning some XLR cables? I don't know. So a lot of, you know, when people apply or when I encourage people to apply, I always say like, ask what, you know, hey, I saw this position. Who is it for? What is it for? Is it more personal? Is it more business? Is it whatever? Because there's no more depressing thing than thinking you're getting your foot in the door in Hollywood and then figuring out that you're just picking up people's kids for a living or, you know, doing advanced dog sitting or whatever that like maybe doesn't have that.
That's my dream
staircase. Job. Yeah, exactly. Doesn't have that staircase into the next level of what you want to do.
I love that you bring up asking thoughtful questions, Charles, because I think I'm pretty good at interviewing based off of my track record of getting a lot of jobs. And I've always had the benefit of, most of the time, I've had the benefit of having somebody who has had the job or a similar job coach me through what the job is and what would be meaningful. And I think the posing of questions is a really good way to show that you're aware of what the job is. And I always like to sort of level up in the sense that my questions are something that demonstrates how I am thinking critically about doing the best version of this work. The showing how I like it's a direct illustration of what value I can bring to the table because I am thinking like three steps ahead. And I have interviewed for assistant in Hollywood jobs and I have interviewed for like very, you know, high paying executive jobs in the ad industry. And the ability to be able to connect dots outside of just the information that's presented in front of you is an indicator of like you as a skilled professional. The other thing that I think about, and I think about the time that I bombed an interview in college before I had taken improv classes, before I had sort of like found my voice or developed confidence in myself. I think it's really important to bring your full self to the interview in the sense that, you know, get excited about what you're excited about for the job. Be who you are. Don't try to put on, if you're not somebody who is like a professional buttoned up suit person, like, and you try to be that, which is what I remember doing when I was interviewing for like some logistics company in Chicago in college. Thank God I didn't get that job. But I remember like showing up in a suit that was too tight and like it wasn't, I was so not me and it felt so inauthentic. And I think that, you know, if you feel that uncomfortable in the job interview, you probably are not the right fit for the job. And so there is value in showing up as yourself in a professional, in a buttoned up way, but like being who you are and being excited about what you are excited about for the job to then find the best match. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
I think it does. I think you should want to be like 20% fancier than your normal you.
Yeah.
I feel like being completely your normal you is maybe a little tricky, but like a slightly fancier version of yourself, I think is good. Cause if you're coming in, you don't want to present something that is completely unsustainable, unrealistic, or like, you should definitely not be showing up in a custom tailored suit to a job interview if it's the only one you own and you have no intent, like, and it's not a custom tailored suit job and you're not willing to invest, you know, in a custom tailored suit wardrobe. Like in Hollywood, you know, a nice press shirt is usually plenty for most of these jobs, depending upon where you are. And again, this goes back to research, right? Like every company now has a social media page. You can see behind the scenes photos of how everyone dresses at the office. You can get a sense of all of this stuff. And one of the jobs is like one part of every single job we do now is research. There is not a job in which research is not a part of it. I'm hiring an assistant. I'm going to expect them to research on things. I'm hiring a writer. I'm hiring a DP. I'm hiring whoever I'm hiring. Part of their job will be researching and doing new stuff. I'm shooting a thing in a couple of weeks and I'm working with a DP and like, we're going back and forth on some tools we want to use for these things. And we're sending images and like research is part of that cinematographer's job. So you want to demonstrate to people in the interview process that you are capable and thorough and engaged in doing that research. Now, the flip side of what Grant shared in this story is I think there's a real power in being honest about our mistakes. Mm-hmm. I think there is a cultural norm of like pretending like we never make mistakes. And I think that there is a desire to project a, you know, every step of the way I knew what I was doing and I made good decisions. And I think it creates, it makes imposter syndrome in other people worse. But I also think it creates, like, you know, this artificial, it doesn't give people hooks in order to engage with you. Whereas I, you know, I thought it was a really beautiful thing. Like, everyone I know has made huge, catastrophic career mistakes. Mm-hmm. And we've all kept going and it's been fine. I mean, my biggest that I always talk about is the advice I give everybody is when you have a short that gets heat, you want to have a project that you are talking about when you take all of those meetings.
Yeah.
And I had a short that got heat and I had a bunch of meetings and I had nothing to pitch. And literally, it was so bad that towards the end of the things, they were so excited about my short and working with me that like there was a book I'd read that I liked that I pitched them and they were like, yeah, great, we'll option that book. And then things didn't end up working out. But like, people want you to come in with a thing to talk about. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, they mentioned that at USC and they knew it was a thing. And what I should have done in retrospect is waited a year to put my short through festivals until I had a project I was ready to talk about. But I was too eager to do that. I wanted it out right away and I didn't have anything to talk about. So I was taking all these meetings with nothing to share. And then everybody was like, all right, well, when you have something, send it to me. And then like 18 months later, when I finally had something to share, everyone had forgotten about me. They were like, who are you? What was this short again? And I talk about that all the time with people that like, you know, you're making that short, you're making the thing to try and engage with people. You should have the project you want to share with people before you try and make all the meetings. Like, there's no real point in having all of those meetings early, unless you're just like the most charismatic motherfucker on the planet. And those meetings will be like, oh, we need to work with them.
Yeah.
But like, who is that person? Who is that person who takes all of those general meetings and is so charismatic? Because in the end, Hollywood is actually full of a lot of charismatic people, and it still goes back to the property.
Yeah.
People still want to work on things. People get excited in a meeting about an idea. Like, that's the most exciting thing. So I think that's the, yeah, that's the big mistake that I always go back to. What about you guys? What did you fuck up royally?
I pitching is something it took me a long time to get correct. Like, I thought probably for a long time. Sorry, my voice is terrible. I was at a Clippers game yesterday and really, really, really gave it to them. But anyway, pitching took me a long time. But like, I think just like the general interview, I always took it like, I think maybe too casually, not that I wouldn't dress nice or whatever, but I was so used to just walking in and talking to people, especially with like the first way I got any job in Hollywood was just meeting an assistant who hired me to be an intern. And I think like the downside of that was like, it was so casual that then even later in life, you know, when I was interviewing to do different jobs or gigs, I would just take it so casual. I think it maybe threw people off and not in a confidence way. And I'm like, does he take this serious way? Where like, I was taking it seriously. I just had no idea how to sit and talk to someone in a professional setting and not, hey, what's up, man? You know, blah, blah, blah. And some people are very receptive to that, but I found that a lot of people aren't. But everyone is receptive to like the, hello, my name's Jason Hellerman. I'm here for this. And then you warm up to them. And I do think there's so many times I put my foot in my mouth or I just like goofed around or would make a joke in an interview that like, it wasn't an appropriate joke or wasn't whatever, but it was not something I felt like had carryover into the real world. And honestly, even now, what I've maybe like the biggest takeaway I have is like, when you're done that interview, you're done. You don't need to keep talking. You don't need, you know, you're not going to talk yourself into it. Just like in a pitch, when you're done pitching, you could say, that's the movie, and then walk away, right? You don't have to continue to talk yourself in or out of it. And anybody that listens to this podcast can tell you, I love to continue to answer questions that maybe don't get asked. So, you know, I think cutting myself off is part of it, and I'll stop there.
I don't know if this is a mistake or a learning or something that I think it's something I'm still sorting through. But occasionally, or a couple times in my career, people have extended invitations to read my work or get coffee or, you know, reach out if you need anything. And I've taken that as genuine. For example, I remember going to coffee with a friend of a friend who has now an overall deal at a big production network. And he gave me great advice. And I still see him out in the world. But he said, you know, send me your pilot. I'll read it. I'd love to read it. And so I sent it and then I just never heard back. And I think there have been these elements of people extending that invitation, but it doesn't feel, I think I was taking it at face value and expecting that I would absolutely get feedback or a read and that not coming back to me. The other thing that I think that I may have done in those situations is I get very, very excited. And obviously I'm excited about what we're doing. And I sometimes meet with people in it out in the wild via networking where like that excitement is matched. And then like an actual genuine connection happens. And other times I think that I am too excited and that it probably weirds people out. I don't know. And then like, I'll take somebody at their word and then I'll never hear back. And I'm like, oh, like maybe they were just saying that. And maybe I just need to like kind of pump the brakes a little bit, which kind of bums me out in the sense that I'm like, well, I want to show up and be my full self. And like, I have found connections, but I think maybe there's an element of me reading the room a little bit more and being mindful of like somebody who might be more of an introvert who's not exactly vibing with my energy, which is very much, you know, getting excited with people. I don't know, but it kind of, it makes me question, you know, if I did something wrong when somebody kind of just falls off the face of the planet like that. What do you guys, do you have any reads on that? I'm processing in real time.
I have a read on it, which is 95% of the time, they're just very busy people who are shit at email.
Yeah.
Like, I assume the more powerful a person is, the worse they're going to be at email. I remember I worked for someone who was like several steps up the ladder from me at once, and like their emails were so atrocious. And then finally, we were in a car together somewhere, and he was responding to like people with real power. And he was just like on his phone, on Siri, responding to emails with like, yes, no, to like people with significant power. And I was like, he had no idea how rude those emails were probably reading to the other people. And it's just like, this is the world he lives in. And like, maybe those people weren't offended by the one word period responses or the lack of response to so many emails. Like, so whenever that has happened to me, I always write it off with, you told me send stuff? I sent stuff. Like, I think it's good as a filmmaker to be very conscious of what we expect back from various people. Like, I have friends I send scripts to, and I expect, like, maybe we'll have a conversation or coffee, or I'll get typewritten notes, or there'll be a big thing. And, you know, and then I have, like, professional contacts. I have a contact right now who's, like, a few steps up ahead of me, and I'm not even going to ask him to read it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say, hey, are you working with a reader right now? Can I send it over and have your reader take a look? I would like, you know, that's typically when people are much higher than me, I always check in to be like, you know, if I don't know what your reader's backlog is like right now, but I would love to, you know, if like, because I know that they're only going to read the coverage anyway. Mm-hmm. And if they don't respond, then the howling phantods at 2 a.m. could be like, they didn't respond because this script is the worst thing they've ever read.
Yeah.
But the truth of the scenario is usually that there's no reason for them to respond because it doesn't fit in their it doesn't fit in what they're trying to do right now for whatever reason. It's too close to something else they're trying to do. There's like a billion normal reasons why you don't respond. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you what, as someone who had a production company in LA that was doing well and we had a reader and people were sending stuff over, if someone thoroughly burned a bridge with me, I actually usually took the time to tell them. Like, yeah, I had this one guy who had gotten my phone number and started texting me like on weekends, all hours, about this idea he had, and he wanted to send me the treatment. And I was like, like 2 or 3 times, I was like, hey, I've got a reader. When the script is done, send it to me. I'll send it to my reader. And he was like, no, you got to get on this idea right now. It's a great idea. The treatment's not done yet, but well, like, I want to pitch it to you. And I was like, at one point I was like, please just don't text me anymore. Like, just don't. And I saw him at Sundance a couple of years later, and he pivoted out of writing, and now he was in talent management, and he was like repping these actors at Sundance. And I just wanted to take the extras aside and be like, this guy doesn't know how the game is played. But there was never a moment. And also, I'm not, maybe he's a great talent rep. Who knows? But when, you know, there are so many people who have sent me things that like I either read it and I didn't have time to respond, or sent it to a reader and the coverage was like not what we were looking for or whatever, that I don't think we should ever take offense at that.
Yeah. Do you think, I actually love that you take the time to give feedback. And, you know, recently somebody who in an Instagram exchange. I don't know this person. He followed me. I followed him back as a producer. And I like responded in the affirmative to just a story he posted. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then he's like, can I send you this like pitch deck and script? And I'm like, sure. And I don't want to read it. And I kind of want to be like, this is like, I felt like I put on the spot, and I kind of want to give that feedback of like,
you should absolutely say no. And you should say no in the politest way possible, but you should absolutely say,
yeah,
I'm actually not the person you want to send this to. I'm not in a position where I'm getting other people's projects made.
Yeah.
I remember my first internship in LA was like 25 years ago. I worked, interned for George Miller's manager. And George Miller already at that point was in a place where he was only, you know, I think George Miller took outside pitches for a couple of years. He did like The Witches of Eastwick. And then everything else, there's probably a couple other I'm forgetting, but mostly George Miller develops his own stuff. Yeah. And like people would call and be like, can we send this to George Miller? And, you know, we were practicing and be like, no, George Miller develops his own stuff. Like the manager's job was to negotiate contracts.
Right.
He wasn't
right.
looking to get George Miller stuff because he was George Miller. So like you are developing your own projects. You're not producing other people's projects. And a very light and polite, like I'm not actually producing other people's projects right now, is totally fine. Actually, it's interesting because like I've been on both sides of this. When I had the production company, I got stuff like this all the time. And sometimes I was looking and sometimes I wasn't. But also a couple of years after I left the production company, I had partial financing put together and I got in touch with an old friend who had a financing fund out of Colorado. And I was like, oh, hey, are you? And he was like, no, I'm just financing the stuff I'm directing right now. And I was like, great. And it was like very polite. And it was like, you know, and it was still a, you know, we're still professional contacts. I'm sure we'll still cross paths. That is a totally fair thing to be like, I'm not the right person for this. That person on Instagram views you as an avenue somewhere.
Yeah.
And you're not that avenue somewhere. Those connections are for your projects right now. At some point in your career, you'll want to produce stuff for other people, but those will also probably be people you already know.
Yeah. Although or people who have taken the time to like mindfully ask, which also I get a lot of requests to like watch short films and give notes, which like I'm happy to do. And I, but when it's a, you know, person who has taken the time to write a kind human email and also be very patient with that feedback.
Yeah. I think it's also, you know, we've all heard those crazy stories like that guy in New Orleans who at 15 made a short film and then on Instagram shared it with Ben Zeitlin, who'd done Beast of the Southern Wild, and he liked it. And so Ben Zeitlin produced the feature. We've all heard that story. And really good for that guy. Great for Ben Zeitlin for doing that. Hooray for everybody. But like, that is the exception by far. Right. That is the like, that is, but like, that is a one in a million roll of the dice. And that's not the typical average thing that anyone should be pursuing or expecting or exploring. Like, that's just not how most of this is going to work for most people. And that's okay.
Yeah. Well, thanks for making me feel like I'm not crazy and hurting other people by sending my scripts. I do think the benefit of the doubt is always a good thing, and like assume that, you know, they're just too busy and just don't have time to read it. I wish I could live that life and not feel guilt for not reading people's things.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. Yeah. It's like part of the animal. It's like, you know, I give feedback to people I have working relationship with and I'm close to, but I can't possibly read every single thing that every single person I know writes. Like there's not the time in the day. Like we just don't, you know, so we develop the relationship with people to give feedback. Mm-hmm. I want to say one last thing, and this isn't my lessons, but these are lessons that I've watched other people fuck up. And so I want to share other people's fuck ups. When you are in the interview, I want to remind everyone that the meal is also part of the interview. If things are going well and you're talking about working with someone and there's like a meal involved, you are still being evaluated on your motherfucking behavior.
Yes.
You should not start telling stories about the time you're on a production and you went to buy the cocaine for everybody. Like, we are still in the process of getting to know each other. And it's like, I have watched so many people do just fine in the first interview. We're like, we do an interview. We're talking to a lot of people. It's great. And then we're like, you know, let's go to Waffles. Like, and then you meet up for at the Waffle on Sunset. I don't even know if that place exists or like wherever. And like in the meal, somehow they feel like they've gotten it or they feel like you're friends. And then stuff comes out and you're like, no, but this is still a job. Like, I don't care if you've done drugs, right? I was once young. Drugs existed. But like, you know, it, you could still be doing drugs a lot if it doesn't interfere with your ability to do your job and deliver on your projects. But specifically, like, the job interview lasts a long time. Like, people can hire you and then, like, a couple of meetings in decide you're not the right fit. So, like, yeah. You know, it is also part of the thing. The whole thing is part of the thing. Yeah. The, like, sitting around and having waters at the beginning and chit-chatting about what's going on in the industry is also part of the thing. It's all part of it. It's all something that I wish I'd taken more seriously as I was doing it. So I just wanted to share that one. I don't think I fucked that one up. I might have fucked that one up and not known it. But I've definitely been on the other side of the table and watched people completely whiff it. When I was like, no, you were in the running like an hour ago. And now I'm just like, I want to be out of this restaurant. I want to be somewhere else. Because I'm like afraid you'll say something and someone at another table will overhear and think I'm party to this.
Oh, cringe.
And like, oh, so it's heartbreaking too, because I'm like, yeah, at a certain, nobody took them aside and explained that. Or they knew that and they still thought these were appropriate workplace conversations, in which case it's a good thing we didn't hire them. Yeah, those are the big things, the takeaways. So the other thing that I thought was really great about Grant Fentz's article that I wanted to talk about today was like, there's so much power in actually owning it and sharing it. And I wanted to leave with that. So from there, Gigi, you've been having some issues and we want to try and glean lessons for everybody.
Yes. So I shot the last scene of my movie on Friday and I had placeholder footage in my premiere timeline ready to drop it in. And all day Saturday, Adobe was crashing. And I looked up this Reddit article that was like, I love it when newbies complain about Premiere crashing. It just comes with the territory. And I've heard this Premiere is premiering like thing, but all the responses to this Reddit thread were like, actually, I don't have this issue. Maybe it crashes once a year. It's all a media management issue. And I'm like, I know I am not managing my media well. I am figuring out proxies, but I am just it's so intimidating. And I'm taking a class on this next month so I can just get over it and learn how to set it up properly. And we're way too deep in the movie to like address the issue. And finally, it was working last night and I cracked a scene that I've been bugging me for years, well, months. This sort of helplessness that you get when like something is not working. And I'm curious what the sort of first basic steps are for troubleshooting. This sounds so 101, but when you're directing and you have a million things on your plate, it's so easy to just like something crashes and then you're like overwhelmed and you shut down when you don't have your editor available.
So the biggest thing that I always say to everyone about tech support is the earlier you set your project up, the better, the happier you will be through the rest of it. And the number one problem is not, this isn't always Premiere's fault. Every once in a while, there will be a real Premiere bug where like, for whatever reason, on this one generation of laptop, Premiere will get crashy. And that is Premiere's problem. It doesn't happen very much. The biggest problem that Premiere has, and they all do this, is that they market capabilities that are not real. Premiere markets, edit whatever you want, throw everything in the timeline, go crazy, have fun. And the biggest problem with that is when you're doing that and you're throwing these big high resolution files into your timeline, everything has to get pulled into the media, the memory of your system. And then you have less system memory to handle other things and it makes Premiere crash more. And so I always say to everybody, and I say it all the time, we are never going to move past the place where you should make some sort of dailies. Resolve calls them, Premiere calls them proxies, which I hate, and I'm not going to go on a rant about why. but we are never going to get there. And the reason why we're never going to get there is because as computers keep getting faster, cameras keep getting faster, right? Like I'm working on a project right now. We're shooting Blackmagic 12K. I've been shooting Blackmagic 12K on everything lately. My super new M2 Ultra Mac handles 12K fine, but I still make 1080p dailies because it's so much easier to deal with those 1080p dailies. Everything just moves smoother with those 1080p ProRes LT dailies. And this is the big one, if I'm having a problem with the scene, it's so much easier to drop them in a Dropbox file and send them to someone over the internet and be like, hey, take a look at the scene. What do you think? What's going on? Like, get, you know, bring in another editor on something, get someone else's eyes. All of that stuff is so much easier with low res files. The bigger your files, the more likely whatever your system is, Premiere, all of those are going to be a problem. The reason why you hear about this less with Avid is Avid from the beginning has always been like, we're going to take whatever you give me and we're going to make our proxies automatically internally and it's going to be a thing. And so Avid annoys a lot of people because it does that, because people are like, it's hard to get stuff into Avid. But Avid does that on purpose so shit doesn't crash. And so like Avid has a reputation for being stable because Avid makes you do it the right way. And so like it's very stable because it forces you into the right thing. Premiere is like, and Premiere is fair to argue, Premiere is fair to market that you can bring in everything and edit it. If you're making a 30-second social video, you can bring in your 12K, edit it, pop it out, it's fine. But like I had a client once who was working on a feature, and this was a while ago, but he was working on a feature and he'd shot 6K raw. And I was like, oh, can you send me a new version of this shot? And an hour later, I hadn't heard. And like, we were under deadline. And I emailed him again. I was like, hey, I need that shot. And he was like, oh, I'm still waiting on Premiere to open. Because Premiere took an hour to open. Because it has to go in and check every single one of those shots. And 6K RAW was too big for the laptop he was working on, yada, yada, yada. But like, the real solution to almost everybody's problem is setting your project up right at the start. Mm-hmm. Which is the same in every other arena. Screenwriting problems are almost always solved in the first act. And if you have, you know, like you're almost never going to do enough drafts to overcome an unlikable protagonist. Right. And like, I'll read friend scripts sometimes and I'm like, no, and they're like, yeah, what can I do? And I'm like, but the person and what they want is unrelatable to most humans. And no number of more drafts are going to make it, like setting things up right from the start makes your life so much easier. So much of screenwriting is like choosing the story you're going to tell. And so much of editing is setting the project up right from the beginning so that it is much easier and more stable. So I think Premiere does have a bad reputation for bugs, which are not always earned or fair. There are like weird little bugs in every piece of software. The other thing you can do is you can try and trace down what we call gremlins. The number one thing that fucks with projects is like, let's say you go shoot your feature and it's like, 90% we shot all on the FX3. For the most part, the FX3 footage is not what's going to make your project crash for some reason. But then you'll like bring in a shot in like the animation codec that you got from a VFX artist or like one like weird thing that you're like, oh, it's this stock footage. And that is almost always the shot that fucks everything up. And one of the first things I used to do, you know, when I had a post house, we'd regularly get projects and they'd be like, it's crashing all the time. This was a Final Cut 7 days, but they'd be like, it's crashing all the time and nothing ever works. And the first thing we would do is we would sort through the timeline and see if there are any weird shots. Because if there's a weird shot, taking that shot and making it a ProRes file fixes so many problems. So if you have any weird shots in your cut, if you're like, oh, this one stock footage shot we got off a weird stock footage site, or like we're comping in a logo on top of something, that shot is almost always the problem. Because for the most part, even if you don't make dailies, like Premiere, the engineers at Adobe know how many people are shooting on the Sony FX6 or the Sony FX3 or whatever. What did you guys shoot on? I forget.
Ari and Alexa.
Oh, you guys shot Alexa. Yeah, Premiere is really good at Alexa footage. Also, Alexa is almost always playing ProRes files. Yeah. So if you're just playing ProRes files Alexa, and you're still crashing?
One of the things that I wanted to do was set up a shared drive, a Google Drive, so we can edit at the same time in different reels, the editor and I. And so we have part of it set up in Google Cloud or Google Drive for desktop.
Oh,
I think
that's going to fuck you up. That's going to fuck you up bad. So the reason why that fucks you up is the way in which Google... Basically, the way in which Google does local versus cloud files, you really need to run that through either Adobe Cloud or Blackmagic Cloud, both of which have better tool sets. So yeah, the problem you're running into is not file-based. Alexa ProRes files, because it's Alexa 2.5K, right? You weren't shooting the LF?
I don't know.
You weren't shooting the LF. You would know if you were shooting the LF. It's newer and more expensive. So you would be aware that it was newer and more expensive, even if you didn't know.
Ours was definitely not, because the camera didn't turn on for 6 hours when we first arrived. And Ryan, our DP, had to go back to an earlier iteration of the software. And that's what got it to turn on.
Yeah. So you had an older one. So yeah. So you have 2.5K ProRes files. That's not going to cause... Premiere is going to be fine at that. So yeah, that's almost always... Yeah, then it's absolutely Google Drive. You shouldn't use Google Drive for editing. You can cut out a Dropbox, because Dropbox is a little more stable. You have to make sure you have your settings correctly in Dropbox in the way in which it addresses the footage. But basically, Premiere is looking in the file system and wants to know where the shot is. And being in Google Drive can fuck up those links, which can cause a lot of crashes.
Yeah.
So yeah, again, setup issue. It's always a setup issue. The real way to do it, if you want multiple people to work on a project at the same time on an independent level, is you just go buy another Samsung T5 and you make a dupe of the footage on that Samsung T5 and you just send it to them in an envelope in the mail. Mm-hmm. And like, that is still legitimately like the way we do it to this day. Like, I'm working on a project with an editor in Colorado and we have identical dupes on our local hard drives of everything and we use the mail. There are tools that make the web easier at better budgets. They exist at the indie level. A Samsung T5 is really hard to beat. They're great.
We do have like the proxies when we were editing separately, like all locally, but things like score, temp score, sound effects, like all of that was being pulled from the drive. And that, looking back, we're like, never again. It worked most of the time. I think the other thing is we've just been having space issues. This is a whole thing where I'm like, it's so worth bringing your editor on early and a post supervisor on early to just advise on the setting up. So, I mean, one of the biggest mistakes we made was creating, like, shooting in a way or creating proxies in a way while we were in Panama that was only compatible with Macs. And so when our post supervisor / sound designer and sound mixer came on board, he had a PC and we had to like reset up everything. And it's these little things, that decisions that are being made at the very, very beginning that end up causing a lot of headaches later on. And that it's such a, I mean, God bless people in post-production, the most patient humans in the world. We're very lucky to have some great people on our team. But yeah, all this stuff, it comes from our the fact that we're green. Like, this is my first feature. It's my producer's first feature. And we just don't have, we didn't even know to know. So it's so worth bringing in those subject matter experts early on.
Well, it's also the reason why we do these, right? Like, you know, you go out and you make a thing and you learn everything from making a thing that'll make the next one better, that'll make the next one better, that'll make the next one better.
Exactly.
All right. So that is this week on the No Film School podcast. Where are you guys on the internet?
I'm at Jason Hellerman on X or Twitter, whatever we're calling it. Jason at nofilmschool.com. Send me an email. Send me some ideas. My voice will be back next week, I promise.
Oh, Jason.
I don't believe you. I think you now live like this.
I am at Lost in Graceland. And two things I want to highlight coming up for No Film School. Tomorrow we have a continued conversation with two of the DPs from the Sundance Roundtable. Rarely do I get to capture the magic of what happens after we stop recording, but these two folks were like, we have to continue this conversation because it's actually arguably more important than anything we've talked about already. So tune in for that. And then next week, in lieu of the No Film School weekly podcast with the three of us, we will be joined by the team of the One More Hollywood podcast, aka Chris Moore and his producers. You may know him from Good Will Hunting, American Pie, Manchester by the Sea, one of the most, Project Greenlight.
Yeah.
So tune in for that. And we're talking about heat. So building off of Charles, the heat of your short film in that moment, we talk about heat at a business industry level and what it means and how, as creators, we can be thinking about it.
All righty.
Do you want to do a sign off, Charles?
Oh, shit. Was I supposed to say something? I'm not even on the internet anymore, so I forgot to sign off. Yeah, guys, I'm basically not on the internet these days. I've sort of like given up on the internet. Like, it's fine. But like, I'm reading books again. So you can try and find me. Email the podcast at whatever our podcast email address
podcast@gmail.com or podcast@nofilmschool.com.
Yes, that's where I am. podcast@nofilmschool.com. And I write like occasional articles on No Film School. So check those out. And I will see you guys around.